Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, and art. I'm your co-host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here as always with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi.
Hello to everybody. Today we will be again looking at how do we democratize design, and we will be interviewing Cluster Cairo, that is a practice from Egypt. Cluster is an acronym for Cairo Lab for Urban Studies, Training, and Environmental Research. And we will be interviewing today Omar Nagati, that is an architect and urban planner, and an artist and designer called Beth Stryker.
It shouldn't come as a surprise to any of our listeners that Emiliano and I consider space to be political. How we organize public space, how we organize our cities and our buildings has political dimensions. So this is an organization that got started during the Arab Spring with the green shoots of democracy kind of coming around in Egypt. And it provoked questions about how do we reorganize the city? How do we reuse public space in a way that aligns with these new democratic values?
I think that really what is quite astonishing of their experience is that really it germinated from this revolutionary moment in which all strata of society, all different kind of people came together in the streets and basically turned down the power. They found themselves in a moment of collective construction of politically what was coming next. And for Cluster Cairo became also an opportunity to look at what could be the tools that design could bring, that architecture and that planning could bring, to keep this plethora of people dialoguing and in conversation on how to improve their city. Somehow their lab became a way to democratize all these different voices to understand together how to form a better use of public space, a more negotiated and shared use of public space, but also how to look at other challenges, like how to address informality and how to look at different ways of formalizing gathering places and different ways of using the city.
And you'll hear this throughout the interview, but they're extremely kind of creative and diverse in the media that they use. So for their whole history, they've been teaching, they've been lecturing, they've been organizing public workshops and public installations. And it's really kind of a consciousness-raising exercise, getting people to understand that along with this political changes and political revolution, there can be a kind of revolution of thought around how we use space, and designers can be at the front end of that.
And in a way, also their idea of advocacy, I mean, most of their projects are unsolicited. So they just do what they think is their role. And so somehow they build projects from below up, but they really involve all parts, from governments to informal workers, to all the people that actually are cohabitating and conflicting in the space. So it's really a practice that I think is really to look at, because they're testing new ways of doing plannings on the run, but in devising really interesting tools and way to succeed.
It's a fascinating story, and they've got a lot of things going on which we know are going to inspire. Beth, Omar, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us and sharing with our audience your time, your perspective on what we know are very important, going to be critical and insightful issues. We're wondering if we could begin with your taking us back to the Arab Spring, and that as a sort of global moment where the world was awoken to a certain sort of political revolution, and how that gave rise to Cluster Cairo and the work that you do.
Yeah, I think this is a good point to start, because actually Cluster as an idea, even though it has been a dream for years to do something alternative practice, but it was really the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring. And that moment when, you know, the whole city and a lot of cities were mobilized, and this sort of urban revolt and the possibility of political action was both the inspiration and also the possibility, the room for alternative practice to take place. Like most of our generation, our colleagues, we were all out in the street the first couple of months. Everybody was out in the street participating in the protest. And then after a while, we realized, as you know, artists and filmmakers and architects, etc., everybody had a different role to play to participate in the process of change. So for us, the question is, how can we as architects and artists and urban planners, etc., how can we deploy some of the tools and methods that we know best to contribute to this process of change? So Beth and I met through a common friend, and we had a lot of common interests. And we wanted to engage this fast-changing process on the ground. So one of the first projects, two projects we did, was basically trying to document and capture this fleeting moment when every day you woke up in the city, something happened. There's a new, protest here, the building being burned, there's a conflict there, there's tear gas, street being blocked. So we wanted to archive a city in flux, as we called it. So the idea was we hypothesized that this moment of a political vacuum when the state was very weak and vulnerable and communities were very emboldened and empowered by the revolution, it created a very unique and temporary condition called a flux. And we sort of proposed that eventually the state will come back and many of these actions on the ground will disappear. And they range from, graffiti to street vendors, quote unquote, taking over the street of Down Tyro to more radical interventions like, community coming together and building a highway to connect, highway exit to connect the neighborhood to the ring road. So all these kind of things were only possible because of the temporary political vacuum or the suspension of order, if you will. So we quickly wanted to capture this and we mobilized and we started to a long project. It's called Archiving the City in Flux. That was one project. And the second project was in parallel, maybe Betty can talk about it, which is basically looking at the creative initiatives also emerging within the same condition.
So the platform Omar is talking about is called the Cairo Urban Initiatives Platform originally. We're now expanding it as the Creative Urban Initiatives Platform. And this was, again, as Omar mentioned, at that time, there were a lot of new initiatives that sprung up. This was in part because of what Omar was describing, people feeling empowered and also there being new opportunities to organize. So we were in particular interested in a lot of the new initiatives that had sprung up and were doing work in relation to public space. And this was across multiple disciplines. So from art and culture, media, advocacy, architecture, urbanism, and so forth. And yet there was no way to find out who these different people are or to coordinate activities or to learn necessarily about where things were taking place. So we started by having a series of stakeholder meetings where we brought together representatives of these different initiatives and we proposed that we would help develop tools for people to share information and share resources. And so the Cairo Urban Initiatives Platform, or QIP, is one of the tools that we created, and it's a directory for all of these different initiatives in the city, as well as a shared calendar. It's available online and it's user generated, and it's something that we started with maybe 35 initiatives, and we developed it through these conversations with them, through these stakeholder meetings. It was also important at that time that people be able to, for example, say if an event had moved, there was a lot of volatility in the city. So we developed this tool in relation to the conditions in Cairo at the time. It's still a very active platform with over 2,000 users every month, and we're now working on expanding that and extending it to Amman, and that's a project that we're working on with Studio X Amman and Columbia Center for Spatial Research.
I think that, what is really crucial, of course, in the beginning, in the origins of your practice, is this new use of public space, which was fundamental for the Arab Spring, because, of course, Tahrir Square was conquering a public space with a completely new function of protest and demand. And so you've been recording all these different uses and developing an initiative that brought together. But then, was there an idea to develop also projects that could somehow consolidate this new approach to public space into something that became later, a new spring or a new phase for the country?
So this is an important question because, from the outside, Cairo was almost reduced to Tahrir Square. But in fact, what we learned during that time is in every little street or back street, there was a little Tahrir Square taking place in a more subtle and slower and gradual, what you call it, a slower urban revolution. And for us, it was, how can we really understand the city not as a only site of protest, which is a spectacular, more organized form of revolution, but through a gradual set of negotiation on everyday level. And unlike, other cities in North America, Northern Europe, where public space is regulated, sometimes over-regulated, in Cairo, there's a huge room in formality. so that the public space is not necessarily, I'm not talking about B Square, even a single street is never used as intended or as planned. So you could see it being turned partially, you know, to a market or vendors or extension of prayer or a art festival, etc. So in every street, we realized that this idea of negotiating competing interests. So the public spaces became a site of contestation and negotiation between different narratives and different modes of organizing space. And so part of our earlier project was try to map that and understanding through street vendors, for example. But the other part is how to turn this information, knowledge that we learn about informal use of public space into a proactive mode of, I don't want to say intervention, but how can we contribute through design and creative intervention to help negotiate and help facilitate this conflict in public space. So what we learned in the early phase of After Revolution is that in absence of a meta-narrative or a meta-public, where it's like one rule governs everybody, the city is reduced to small factions and fights between different groups. It doesn't have to be a civil war, but could happen on a small street level. So how to find a way in absence of a mode of governance to develop through design ways to negotiate the interests of a street vendor, the shop owner, the residents, with women, with youth, with elderly, etc., etc. And you can name dozens of stakeholders who don't share necessarily one common understanding of what a public space should be like, to whom it belongs and who controls it and who manages it, etc. So our project that we kind of the second phase of our practice was moving a bit from mere observation and analysis and mapping and research to proactive proposition to use the tools that we have as designers to promote a more accessible and diverse public space. So the passageway project, because maybe Beth, you can elaborate a little bit, started out with this idea. And we identified one urban typology through our everyday experience downtown as we walk. It's a very simple gap between buildings, but it's also more than just a physical gap. It's a metaphor of mediation and negotiation between the public and the private realm, between the formal and informal, but also as a transitional space, because the passageway or the in-between space is a passageway from A to B. So it's also a metaphor of political transition or a transition from condition to another condition. So it was a very attractive urban space or typology, and we wanted to look at this public space as a microcosm of the city at large to test this hypothesis of negotiation and the role of art and culture as catalyst, but also to look at these public spaces or these little small spaces, these gaps between buildings all together as a network, as an alternative framework to reimagine the city from the inside out. So instead of looking at the city from the main street and square, looking at the city from the fissures and the cracks, because they're also a metaphor of political action we can talk about later. But this project became really one of our core practice because it really exemplified our whole practice from mapping and research to design and implementation and et cetera. So I'll let Beth talk about the specifics of this project within this framework.
Yeah, I mean, as Omar said, we started off, as with archiving the city in flux, by documenting and mapping these passageways downtown. And there are, I don't know, somewhere around 100 or so that we did this documentation of. And we also, at the same time, tried to identify passageways where we might attempt some of these pilot interventions, these design interventions that Omar referred to. So we now have gone forward. We have all of the original mapping is actually available online. We did build a website called Cairo Downtown Passageways, where we're able to share a lot of the material that we had done, also looking at the tangible heritage in these passageways and interviews with stakeholders and so forth. And then the two passageways that we identified, one is the Kodak Passageway, and then there's a nearby Phillips Passageway. And we did a design workshop, I guess it was in 2014, I want to say, yeah, with DETI and CKU, which were two Danish agencies that we worked with. And we took all of the information that we had from working in these passageways, and we had put together a design brief that was based on the interviews with the stakeholders in terms of what they did and didn't want to see in these public spaces. And we used that design brief as the basis for, it was a four-day workshop with Egyptian and Danish designers and architects to come up with concepts for the two passageways. And then we shared these outcomes with the public and had a juried review. And the two winning concepts for the Kodak was the green oasis, and for Philips was the light oasis. Philips is more of a service alley. It was a bit dark. I didn't feel very safe. In some of the interviews we had done with women's rights groups, it was felt that it was discouraging to women, that it didn't feel safe in part because of some of the uneven pavement and so forth. So part of what we were interested in both of these spaces was how to create also a more diverse and accessible public space. And then we at Cluster took these concepts and we developed the designs and we redeveloped the two passageways. So in Kodak, it's a pedestrian park with custom pathways and lighting and benches. And we can talk more about the negotiations around the design, and maybe Omar can talk about some of the concept of urban diplomacy that we developed through our design practice there in the redesign of Kodak and Philips. And in Philips, we did marquee lighting to bring attention to the shops that were in the passageway. We also created a space where film projection could happen. We collaborated with Cimatech, which is a independent film space downtown, and we did film screenings there. Again, looking at the role that art and culture can play as a catalyst for development. And these were inaugurated in January of 2015 as these sort of new public spaces. Again, at this point, working with the government, working with multiple agencies in order to make these changes in public space. And the spaces themselves have been fairly successful. We created a board for their maintenance to engage the local stakeholders, and they continue to be maintained and activated through exhibitions and workshops, and the garden is thriving and so forth. So
we hope you're enjoying this interview with Beth Stryker and Omar Negati of Cluster Cairo, but we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, Beth and Omar are going to tell us a bit more about how they get students involved in their projects and how to confront informality in developing megacities. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We are continuing our conversation with Omar Negati and Beth Stryker from Cluster Cairo. After hearing about how during the Arab Spring they felt the urgency to work on public space, we will be looking more closely at the most recent projects of one of the most radical and promising practices in Northern Africa.
And what role does education play in all this? I mean, we know that there are a lot of workshops and research, and I'm just curious, how do you draw in young people to these sorts of programs and get them involved and give them a sense of their own power in affecting this kind of change?
Pedagogy is a big part of our practice. And even with the mapping that we did, we have an internship program that we do where we invite students from local universities and we train them. And we have done over the years a couple of different internship programs focusing on the downtown passageways and engage the students in the mapping process, even in developing some design concepts for new passageways that we're now currently working on. And we've also collaborated with international institutions on additional workshops and programs with Sheffield University and with ETH. And maybe, Omar, you can talk a little bit more about those pedagogical projects.
The way we envision Cluster to be partially a independent research and design platform, but also there's a big emphasis on knowledge transfer and learning, co-learning space. So the fact that we really are very fiercely guarding our independence, we are not part of a university, we're not part of the private sector, not part of the government, means that students get the opportunity to sort of experience the way projects are not only being practiced, but how they conceived. 90% of our projects are self-generated. We don't wait for a client to knock on our door and said, we want to hire you to do this. most of the topics and the themes and the project we did were actually a reflection of our everyday experience. Something happens in our backyard, you know, researching the city in flux or street vendors or passageways, etc. But all things that we in our everyday experience, and we take notice of it and we start to critically map it. And then we turn it, when we have enough, let's say, examples or juicy material, we turn it into a proposal, and then we try to, to convince somebody to fund it, somebody to implement it, et cetera, et cetera. So this is almost like the reversal of conventional practice in architecture and design in general. And that's, for students, is also a very important lesson of how to develop this kind of guerrilla architecture. That's one part of it. The second part of it are the tools and methods. And again, I used to teach in universities here, and I got a little bit alienated myself because, you know, many of the curriculum and methodology are a little bit either outdated or, you know, very orthodox. So to try to break away and start to develop something experimental was difficult to do it within university campus. So we tried to do that in our practice. So students are exposed to this alternative way of engaging stakeholders or mapping or critical interventions, et cetera, et cetera. So I think both in terms of conceptualization and in the tools and methods, students get a full spectrum from research and design and implementation. And as Beth said, we have a very robust internship program over the last few years.
What I also find, incredible about this approach that, as you say, is mostly unsolicited, is that you have been covering not only the issues that you have been discovering in downtown Cairo, but you also have been looking at informality in the outskirts. I mean, Cairo is a huge city that has been growing really quickly in the past years. So could you maybe tell us a bit more about your tactics and your strategies in the overall development of this larger kind of extension of the city?
Yeah, no, it's an important question because, you know, informality is automatically perceived as areas that are at the outskirts of Cairo that are self-built, and they constitute around 70% of the housing stock. So they are not a marginal or exceptional, you know, these are the mainstream urbanization. So 2/3 of the city is built without architects and planners and policymakers. This is something that we either as professionals take it seriously on its own terms and try to work within it, or we marginalize ourselves, we render ourselves irrelevant because we're not part of the city. But interesting enough, informality is not exclusive to the city periphery or the margin. It's actually within the city center, such as downtown Cairo, you find these layers of informality within each and every building. So, for example, you could find a building that is turn of the century, neoclassic architecture, very formal, but it's actually undergoing a process of informalization for decades because of rent control, because of lack of maintenance. So you found, you know, the light shaft being turned into, you know, chimney for whatever grid house, or the entrance of the building being turned into somebody selling soft drinks, or the rooftop is turned into an area lived by service workers, etc. So and many of the apartments are being turned into warehouses or storage spaces. So this informalization of the formal structure is something that we're very interested in, both in public space but also in the building. However, we do also work in the city, informal areas around the city center and the periphery. We have a number of projects that started maybe in 2011 or 12. We were looking at this very moment of flux when communities in every neighborhood, informal areas, but everywhere, were actually very much interested to change the neighborhood. So they started to propose ideas to enhance the living environment and the quality of life. So one of the projects we worked on early on called Ard al-Liwa Community Park, it was a project that was initiated by the local community to turn one of the very few empty lands, available lands, into a park, community park, and some services that are lacking, such as a hospital and school and sports facilities. So they actually, at that point when the power relation was very much tilted towards the community, very young activists got together and went and met the prime minister and asked him to grant them this land, state land, to be community park. And when it was approved, they came to us as cluster to help them turn their vision into a scheme, a blueprint. So our role was not really to lead the community or to initiate the vision, but we actually were following their initiative. And for us, it was also a very interesting experimentation of how to reverse the classic kind of participatory model of planning in which the planner or the architects have an idea and then they go to the community, get their feedback. In that case, it was the opposite. The vision started from the community and we were just offering the technical expertise and partnership. Lately, we did also a very important project, a two-year program with University in Zurich, architecture department called ETH. And the idea was to try with students to try to unlock, to decode these seemingly chaotic, random neighborhoods. Of course, they're not chaotic, they're not random, it's just they are not accessible to academics and policymakers because they don't understand how it works. So they assume it's just springing out of nowhere. But there are certain rules and codes, local codes, governing the width of the street, the height of the building, the location of the entrance, etc., the building material. So we wanted to deconstruct that, try to understand it so that we can find a way to also participate in the process without dismissing it altogether. So it was a two-year project. We worked with local contractors and, you know, businessmen and communities, etc., etc. The work of the students would come to Cairo once a semester to do interviews and analysis, and we go back to Zurich and work with them for reviews. And it all culminated in a book called Housing Cairo, The Informal Response, which came out earlier this year and won two big awards in Germany and in the UK. And it really also demonstrates this attempt to work with informality on its own terms, not to objectify it or to essentialize it into this or that. So it's a very kind of open and vulnerable position by the architects and academics to acknowledge that there's something beyond what we learn at school that needs to be understood. And we have to go there with a certain humbleness and work with local contractors and learn from them.
That's a very powerful statement, and glad you mentioned it. Much of our audience is actually young designers, and I think humbleness and humility is an extremely valuable thing for them always. We're wondering if you could take us into the present. You know, the Arab Spring is now 6 years gone by. You guys have developed this, you know, huge plethora of online resources and this sort of thing, and a great many projects that we're going to feature on our website. Where are we at right now in terms of the evolving political discourse, specifically in Cairo and I guess in Egypt in a more larger sense? And where do you see the future of Cluster Cairo heading?
Back when we started archiving the city in flux, one of the things that Omar mentioned was we were looking at this as a temporary condition, anticipating the return of order. So now we are in that moment where there is definitely a very strong governmental presence in terms of the oversight of public spaces, and in downtown in particular, where we do a lot of our work, there is a lot of investment currently in terms of renovations of buildings downtown. There's a newly appointed presidential committee on downtown. And so what we've been looking at as Cluster is how can we be a part of that conversation, and also how can we advocate for some of the communities that we work with, in particular in downtown, looking at the art and culture communities so that they might also have a voice in the future of downtown. So some of the activities that we're involved with, for example, with our pilot projects, and we are continuing the Cairo Downtown Passageways project. Right now, we're working on implementing a project that would include a new passageway redesign, a creative anchor space that would also be a co-working space and have a fabrication lab, and a rooftop publicly accessible garden with potentially a solar energy component. So we're interested in how can we use our pilots to also present models for what is possible in terms of the future of downtown. And for us, this is very important, in particular because a lot of the renovations that we are seeing, for example, they tend to focus on the facades, and there's a certain sort of whitewashing that's going on. And yet a lot of these buildings are sort of rotting from the inside out. And so part of what we're trying to do with our pilot redesign right now is also look at how can we use these mechanisms to both introduce new public spaces and thinking about the possibility of a landscape of public rooftop gardens, for example, but by making that connection to the street, actually upgrading the infrastructure of the building. So really addressing this holistically. This is just one example. It's a way that we, you know, will both be engaging with government plans, but also, again, trying to see, can we try and take some of what we've learned and introduce that into the current redevelopment efforts? And we also do continue to produce public programs. We did a conference called Creative Cities, Reframing Downtown Cairo, in 2015. We just had a publication come out this past year where we brought together people from the government, from the private sector, from the arts and culture community. And again, in Cairo, there really isn't a mechanism for people's voices to be heard. So we try and use these forums as a way to bring together people so that voices can be heard and create an environment where also the communities who are impacted can learn about the plans that are being developed for downtown, because otherwise there really isn't a lot of information available. Like Omar had said earlier, you could wake up in the morning and suddenly there's no parking on the street, but there's no advance notice and so forth. So we're trying to help support some of this dialogue.
We're trying to develop alternative tactics to work within the system through, let's say, a reformist approach. And this sort of tactical of, let's say, subversive tactic is to work within the cracks within the system, both geographically in a city through these kind of in-between spaces, or, you know, politically, we can engage the different levels of government, and there's always loopholes in between, and you can always decide on which level you approach and which narrative, which language, and which visualization to present, to try to find a way within the cracks, because the seemingly a coherent structure is a myth. You know, within each structure, there are certain gaps and cracks and fissures. And so the tactics that is more in tune with the current condition is this tactics of working within the cracks as opposed to confronting the whole system.
Omar, Beth, thank you very much. I think that's a very good, you know, it's a wonderful statement to stop with. And also it's a very hopeful one, because I think that the only hope that we really have in the future is if, you know, design, if urbanism, if master planning can really follow people's needs and also aspirations, not just, you know, the architect's ones.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We'd like to thank our guests of the week, Omar Nagati and Beth Stryker of Cluster Cairo, who've been growing a progressive architectural experiment out of the soil of the Arab Spring. Next week, we'll be moving from Cairo back to small town USA, and hope you'll join us for more thoughts on how to democratize design. You can find more information about Cluster Cairo on our website at currystonedesignprize.com. Also, if you'd like to learn more about the Cairo Urban Research Library, you can find them at www.clustercairo.org/cluster/websites/curl, C-U-R-L. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for all the latest news on social impact design. We shall be